Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Great treat from 50 years ago is going to be discussed tonight. Len Furman, the sports time traveler, comes and tells us about the great and remarkable season of the 1973 New York Mets and the remarkable comeback from deep in despair. Len's up in just a moment to tell us all about it.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my friends of sports history. This is Darren Hayes of the Sports Jersey Dispatch Podcast. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your place for all things great in sports history. And boy, do we have a special one for you today. We have our friend Len Furman coming back to talk about one of his favorite baseball teams and one of the most interesting dynamic teams in MLB history, the Mets of New York, 1973. Len, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Thanks, Darren. Thanks again for having me on your podcast. It's a real honor to be here, especially being from Jersey myself. Any podcast with the name Jersey in it is very special for me to be on. Before we start, I'd like to take a moment to dedicate my guest appearance here tonight to my wife's father, Anthony Bonney, who passed away over the weekend. Anthony was a real unsung hero. He's literally the only person I've ever known who benefited the lives of tens of millions of people. He worked for several decades for the United States Agency for International Development, and he was personally in charge of overseeing the distribution of medications in poverty-stricken areas around the globe. He actually spent many weeks every year visiting Africa, South America, and the Far East to implement his programs. Tony, as I called him, he had an amazingly deep, booming voice that would have been perfect for this podcast tonight. Tony, we're going to miss you forever. I also personally owe Tony quite a bit. He loved reading my articles, and he was one of the people that gave me lots of support and encouragement as I developed the Sports Time Traveler over the past year. So thanks for letting me take that moment.
Yeah, if I could just interject, on behalf of the listeners and myself, we wish our deepest sympathies and condolences for you and your family and your wife during these times. So, and thank you for sharing that little bit about Tony and what he did for the world and for you personally. So thank you for that.
Thanks. Yeah, he was really an amazing person. I'd like to just take another moment to explain to your audience, what is the Sports Time Traveler? So it's a newsletter and podcast I developed last year. The premise is that I travel back in time virtually via systematically reading newspaper archives each day exactly 50 years ago. And then I come back to the present and write stories as though I'm delivering a firsthand account. And I only post articles or podcasts when there's something so exciting or so compelling, I just have to share it. So that's what the Sports Time Traveler is.
And folks, you may have seen this name popping up. Not only was he on Pigskin Dispatch just a couple weeks ago, talking about a great Colgate football team from 1932, but Len has graciously allowed us to share part of his feed in our daily newsletter. So you probably see that in a feed of some of our friends that have some posts on there. And I've been following these Mets as you've been posting them, and I'm sure a lot of the audience has. So we're really excited to hear what you have to say about them.
Yeah, so one of the main genesises of the Sports Time Traveler was my love for the New York Mets. Now I cover all sports, I cover all different stories, but I have a special focus right now on the New York Mets because exactly 50 years ago, they were in last place in the National League East and looking like they were going nowhere. And here's a spoiler alert for everybody. If you don't want to know what happened, I'm going to let you know right now. This is the spoiler alert. But they are going to go on an absolutely unbelievable run from last place in the National League East to first place. And then they're going to play the Cincinnati Reds, the big red machine, one of the great teams of the 1970s, and they're going to beat them and win the National League pennant. And then they're going to go all the way to the World Series against the Oakland A's. I'm going to leave it off there and not tell you, not tell the audience what happens further. But I was a 9-year-old boy back in the summer of 1973. And I was one of those kids that baseball and the New York Mets just meant everything to me. And the players in the New York Mets, they were my heroes. And I was following the Mets every day. And I remember the doldrums of the summer of 1973. They from the time school let out in, near the end of June until here we are, it's August 7th. This whole summer, they're in last place. And it just doesn't look like they're going anywhere. And then at some point, they're going to take off. Now, the interesting thing for me is, again, the genesis of the Sports Time Traveler was I wanted to relive this because this was really like a foundational experience for me growing up to see this happen. But I don't remember how it happened. I just remember the arc of the story. So I'm so excited as we're getting to this point now where the Mets are going to, at some point, they're going to start climbing out of last place. In fact, every day that I'm reading the newspaper archives, I'm still stunned that they're still in last place. And so I'm so excited to follow this day by day over the next 8 weeks as we run through the end of the season. And then again, share it with my audience. You can both read my articles and listen to my articles. And I'm not going to be writing every day, but I'm going to be writing. My promise to my readers is I only write when there's a story so exciting that I just have to share it with you. But for the diehard Mets fans and the people who really want to know every day, just this week, I've started on my website, which is separate from where my articles are posted. My articles are posted in Substack. And I have a website that's just a pointer to get there. It's very simple, thesportstimetraveler.com. So if you go to my website, you'll find the link to get to my articles. But now you'll also see a new page called 1973 Mets Updates. And there, in days I don't run articles, I post a short update on what happened exactly 50 years ago to the Mets. Because I know some people want to see every day what's going on, and some don't want to get overwhelmed by too many articles about the New York Mets.
Yeah. Len, before we get too much into the season, why don't we give a sort of that 50,000 foot view of who the Mets are in 1973. I mean, there's some very recognizable names, including the manager of the Mets. And maybe you could share some of that with the listeners.
Yeah. So the manager is Hall of Fame catcher Yogi Berra, who I think he was on about 12 pennant winning teams with the Yankees from 1949 through 1964. And so he's the manager of the team. And they have some really interesting personnel. In the spring of 1972, when Willie Mays was 40 years old, he was playing on the San Francisco Giants. The New York Mets made a deal to bring Willie back to New York to finish his career. Baseball fans probably know Willie Mays started his career playing for the New York Giants in the 50s, and then he moved to San Francisco when the Giants went to San Francisco, and he played there from 1958 till early 1972. And then Joan Payson, the owner of the Mets, had always coveted Willie Mays. She was a big Willie Mays fan going back to the beginning of his career. And she was able to pull off this deal to bring him back so he could finish his career in New York. And so the Mets have Willie Mays. And I remember as a 9-year-old kid again, it was kind of surreal for me to have this legend on our team. We didn't have the big name hitters. The big name hitters back then were people like Willie Stargell, Willie McCovey, Hank Aaron, Billy Williams, Pete Rose, Joe Torre. We didn't have any of those guys. And so, and even though Willie Mays was at the end of his career, he wasn't a power hitter anymore. It was kind of surreal to have Willie Mays on our team. And one of the things I've been doing this summer in the Sports Time Traveler is trying to redefine the narrative around Willie Mays' last season, because he took a lot of flack that season. There had been a nationally syndicated article back on May 10th, 1973, that said in the headline, it said something like Willie Mays is washed up. I mean, that's really, you know, a real dig. And yet the fact of the matter is Willie Mays actually had the best spring training of his entire career in 1973. This was something that just stunned me as I was following the Mets. I've been following them day by day since spring training. And he actually batted 350 in spring training, led the team in home runs. Very interestingly, it was the first time and the only time he ever played a spring training in Florida, because the Giants always had their spring training in Arizona. Even when they were the New York Giants, they played in Arizona. So something about being in Florida in that hot, humid weather just agreed with him. And then he goes up north in April. And, you know, in New York in April, as you know, it's cold. And so he got off to a really poor, horrific start to the season. And then he got hurt and he was batting 0.95. I mean, that's just off the charts low, as late as June 10th. But then he goes through a resurgence. And this seems to have gone unnoticed, probably because if you just looked at his batting average day to day, it was climbing up through the hundreds and it got up into the low 200s. And nobody thinks when you're batting 220 that you're having a good season. But if you throw out the point where it was cold and he was injured, and if you just look from the middle of June here till the middle, almost the middle of August, he's batting very respectably, almost 300. And then he has a few games where he hits game-winning hits, hits very important home runs. So actually, Willie Mays, in the middle of the summer of 1973, is contributing very strongly to the team. And in fact, he has one game in Atlanta that I wrote an article about that was really interesting. I titled it, Willie Mays Say Hey, New York Never Saw This. There was a game on a Monday night in the middle of July 1973 where in those days, it was on a Monday night, the only game that was allowed to be on television anywhere in the country was the NBC Monday night game of the week. And the Monday night game of the week that week did not involve the Mets. So the Mets are playing in Atlanta and the game is not on television, not in New York, not in Atlanta, nowhere. And less than 10,000 fans come to the stadium. And so almost nobody gets to see Willie Mays have one of the greatest plays in his entire career. A lot of baseball fans will remember Willie Mays became mega famous, became the legend he is when he made what was called the catch in the 1954 World Series, where he caught a drive where he played in the Polo Grounds that had almost a 500-foot center field in 1954. It's kind of hard to imagine. And there was a batter for the Cleveland Indians hit a long drive and Mays long high drive. Willie Mays turned around with his back to the infield and ran almost all the way back to the 500-foot wall and caught the ball while he's got his back to the infield. It was absolutely stunning. Well, he does almost the exact same thing in Atlanta, except Atlanta in July 1973 didn't have a 500-foot fence. They had a 400-foot fence. And he runs smack into the fence and he gets knocked down and the ball pops out. And the batter goes for an inside the park home run, but he did catch the ball. He caught the ball. It was stunning. And the newspaper accounts at the time, both in Atlanta and New York, talk about how unbelievable it was. And yet in Atlanta and New York, there were no pictures. There were no pictures of this. So I was so intrigued by this that and this is one of the interesting things I do. I'll search 30, 40 newspapers trying to find angles, different angles on a game. And I was so excited when in the Tampa Times, I found pictures, and not just one picture, but a four picture spread of this catch in Atlanta that looked just like the famous catch from the 1954 World Series. So that was one of that kind of discovery. I called it like a bit of sports travel, time travel archaeology, because I discovered these pictures that nobody in New York ever saw. And so I put them in my article, and I was just so excited to see that. But that's sure. so
Very cool. Now, would you say in your research, Willie Mays, who's now probably the say hey adult at this point, he's not say hey kid anymore at this age of 40. Would you say that his sort of resurgence during the season was a parallel to what the Mets were doing?
Not really. While he's having this resurgence, the team is still in the doldrums, and they still are right now. So right now, as I mentioned, since near the end of June, in my framework at the time was that's when school let out in New Jersey, they sunk into last place. They're still in last place now. So right now, as we talk, they're 48-60, 11.5 games behind the St. Louis Cardinals. The New York Times has just about written the Mets off. So even though he's having a resurgence, the rest of the team is still struggling. Now, the one player who is not struggling is their franchise player, Tom Seaver. Tom Seaver was one of the great starting pitchers of the 1970s. He was a member of the 1969 Miracle Mets, and Seaver's having an outstanding season. And one of the striking statistics I came across when I actually did a little mid-season grades for the Mets players when we got to the All-Star break, which was about 10 days ago. And at that time, Tom Seaver was the only player that I saw fit to give a grade of an A to. And here was a telling statistic. Seaver, when he starts, in the first 21 games that he started in 1973, the Mets were 13-8. When he didn't start, they were 29-43. So they're a pretty good team when he starts. They're terrible when he doesn't start. So Seaver's clearly the MVP of the team. He's got a 2.02 ERA at that point. Actually, now it's down to 1.97. When I say now, I mean here in the first week of August, 1973. And so, you know, he is clearly their star. He's the one player on the team that legitimately made it to the All-Star game. Seaver was at the All-Star game, and then Willie Mays was actually placed on the team by the commissioner because people just wanted to see Willie Mays, even though he hadn't really earned a spot on the All-Star team. Nobody had a problem with that.
Now was it announced like before that season that it would be his final season, or was
I don't think it was announced, but it was clear.
Okay. There was sort of his farewell tour. So people, that's maybe why the commissioner did that.
They didn't really have a farewell tour, but it was clear. When he got into spring training, a lot of people were saying that he wasn't even sure if he was going to play. He was going to see how he was doing in spring training and then make a decision. Well, then he had that fantastic spring training, so he continued on. But you know, when he was, you know, batting in the low 200s, it was pretty clear this was going to be. And he's 42 years old. It was pretty clear this was going to be his last season. Now some of the other players on the Mets at that time, in right field, they had Rusty Staub. Now, Rusty Staub was actually a pretty solid player. He was in the middle of his career. He'd had some pretty strong seasons, but he had gotten hurt the year before and had barely played. And then he got off to a terrible start in 1973. But by this time in 1973, Staub's really starting to come around, and I gave him a grade of a B. They also had a really solid second baseman in Felix Mion. He came over in a great trade with the Atlanta Braves in the offseason before 73. And Mion was also heating up now. He batted .386 in July. At first base,
that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's really good. At first base, they had John Milner. Milner was third in the rookie of the year voting the year before, hitting 17 home runs. Now he's got 19 home runs. So he's their power hitter, and he's pretty solid at first. At shortstop, they've got Bud Harrelson. He's one of the great defensive shortstops in the National League at the time. But the problem is Harrelson's been hurt a lot. And he's another one who, like Seaver, when he plays for the Mets, they were at this point in the season, when he was playing for the Mets, they were at least 500. They were 30-30. When he wasn't playing and he was out a good portion of this season, they were 12-21. And at this point, he's still out. He actually fractured his sternum, and he's going to miss at least two more weeks. They also have another starting pitcher who last year looked like he could be almost as good as Seaver. John Matlack actually won the Rookie of the Year award in 1972. So the Mets had the first and third leading vote getters in the Rookie of the Year award last season in 1972. But Matlack gets off to a terrible start, like many Mets players in 1973. And at this point, he's starting to come around, notably not playing well at all. At this point is Jerry Kuzman. Kuzman, known as Kuz by the Mets fans, had been the solid number two starter on the Mets' 1969 Miracle Team. He won two games in the 1969 World Series, but he is pitching terribly at this point in 1973, and they really need him to come around. And one more player I want to mention, because he's going to be instrumental in the turnaround, is relief pitcher Tug McGraw. Now, Tug McGraw, from 1969 through 1972, might just have been the best relief pitcher in the National League. But in 1973, there is something wrong with Tug McGraw. His ERA, when I did the midseason grades a couple of weeks ago in July 1973, was 6.17. And he had blown more saves and lost. He had more blown saves and losses than saves. So he is really pitching poorly.
That's a lot of late inning runs you're giving up there, six ERA.
But Tug McGraw is going to feature very prominently in the Mets turnaround, which is going to start happening at some point. I don't know when, but it's going to every day. As I said, every day I look in the newspaper, they're still in last. I'm scratching my head like, how does this happen? And I last week I ran an article that I called The Pennant Races Begin. When I ran the article on August 1st, because that's like really for true baseball enthusiasts, August 1st is really the traditional date when you really start focusing on the pennant races. And so I looked at where were some of the teams that prior to 1973, the teams who had made great comebacks, where were they at this point? And none of them were near where the Mets are at this point in 1973. The Giants in 1951 were in second place, 9.5 games behind the Dodgers. That's the team that, if you recall, the Bobby Thompson home run and the frantic radio call, the Giants win the pennant, the Giants win the pennant. That was that Giants team in 1951. But they weren't in last place. They were in second place. And if you go back further, there was the 1914 Braves. They were known as the Miracle Braves. And they had just a 500 record on August 1st. They were in fourth place, and they came back and won the pennant. But again, they were not 12 games under and in last place. So as far as I can tell, there was no precedent for what the Mets are about to do in 1973. And that's one of the things that's going to make this really exciting following this team over the next 8 weeks.
Yeah, I'll bet. And maybe I should ask this question near the beginning of this little lecture we're getting here on the Mets. But what were the expectations coming into the 73 season? How were the Mets in 72? Were they like on the upswing, or, you know, what kind of team were they expecting?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So you got to go back just a little bit further. They won the World Series in 1969. That was a true miracle, because the history of this team was they were a franchise franchise expansion team in 1962. From 62 to 68, they were the laughingstock of baseball. I think they had the worst record in history over that 7-year period. And then they win the World Series in 1969. I mean, that's a true miracle. They won 100 games. It wasn't like this year's team. They weren't in last in the middle of the season. They were a solid team all season, had a strong finish, win the World Series. So the expectations when you're in New York, if you win the World Series, you're going to do it again. And in 1970, 71, and 72, they're okay. They're over 500. They win 82 or 83 games each year, but they don't come close to winning the division or really contending. Now, going into 1973, there was some hope for them, because again, they'd had two good rookies in 72. They had Tom Seaver, Tug McGraw. They were hoping that Rusty Staub would come back from injury and be a real solid cleanup batter. So they did have some hope there. And they actually started out well. They actually won 12 of their first 20 games. And then they go into this malaise, and and have lots of injuries. Cleon Jones, one of the heroes of 1969, misses a large portion of the season. Jerry Grody, the starting catcher, has missed a large portion of the season. I already mentioned Harrelson's been in and out. John Matlack, one of the problems he had early in the season was he got struck on the forehead by a batted ball in May and actually fractured his skull. So he came back only 12 days later, but he wasn't pitching very well until July. So they had a lot of problems with injuries. And one of the really interesting things I found, again, this is kind of this sports time travel archaeology, was I actually found an article written, of all places, in Rock Hill, South Carolina, by a sports writer there. And he said in middle of July, you know, the Mets are starting to have some of their regulars come back that were injured. If they can have the whole team healthy, I think they can make a run at the division. That is just mind-boggling that he actually said that. And of all places, in Rock Hill, South Carolina, you wouldn't even think they're following the New York Mets there. Yeah. So yes, to answer your question, the expectations were positive going into the season, but they quickly slid downhill. And by this time, nobody except that one guy in Rock Hill, South Carolina, thinks they can do anything.
Now, you're talking about quotes. It made me think about when I was preparing for this, and I knew Yogi Berra is involved in this. And of course, Yogi Berra, not only for his fine managerial skills and playing skills on the field, but he is a great quote and always has something entertaining to say. Now, for this, it's probably later on than the beginning of August when he says this, but he made a quote in that 73 season, says, "You're not out of it until it's mathematical." It's just a typical Yogi Berra, and always a good chuckle when you have him say something.
Yeah, he had some great ones. One of my favorite ones is the game is something like 90% mental and the other 50% is physical.
Yeah, the listeners and I were all taking our shoes off and everything, trying to count up those percentage points right now. Yeah, definitely. But it must have been really inspiring for the Mets that year. I mean, not only having greats like Willie Mays and Yogi Berra, Seaver and Tug McGraw, people that experienced winning both on the Mets and with other franchises in Major League Baseball. But I believe 69 was also pretty magical for the other team that played in Shea Stadium that year. Because wasn't it the same year that the Jets won Super Bowl III?
Yeah, so the Jets won Super Bowl III in January of 69. So it was for football, it was the 1968 season, but yes, they were playing in Shea Stadium. And it actually, the Jets actually began a really incredible time for New York sports, where the Jets win the Super Bowl in 69, at the beginning of 69, the Mets win the World Series in 69, and then the Knicks in the 1969-70 season win the NBA championship, which they wrapped up in April of 1973. So really unbelievable winning in football, baseball, and basketball in a very short span of time.
Yeah, the only thing could have been better is maybe if the Nets did it, so they have the three rhyming teams all winning that year. So the Knicks, but...
Well, when you bring up the Nets, I do want to mention something interesting. So after this 1973 season ends, I want to tell you about a couple of projects that I'm going to be working on. What teams am I going to be following closely? And one of them is going to be in the spring of 1974 is going to be the New York Nets in the ABA, because this is going to be the first season that Julius Erving, Dr. J, is playing for the Nets. And that's going to be a real magical season. I don't want to give it away, but that's going to be a real magical season for the New York Nets. And I don't know much about that at all, because I was still I was a Knicks fan at that time. I became a Nets fan when they moved to New Jersey and became the New Jersey Nets in the NBA, but that's not till 1977. So in 1974, I wasn't really following that. And that's really going to be a great story. The other thing I want to mention for all of your football fans is that, as you know, we lost Jim Brown a few months ago. And when Jim passed away, I thought there's no better way I can honor Jim Brown than to go back in time exactly 60 years this fall and follow his best season in the NFL in 1963. And that kind of really fits what I do in the Sports Time Traveler, because I said I go back exactly 50 years, but I'll also go back exactly 60, 70, 80, 90, or 100 years. I will only go back those exact decades. And so I'm going to go back in time and follow week by week his 1963 NFL season, which I know nothing about. And so I'm really looking forward to that. All I know is his total yardage, and I won't give that away, but it's going to be his best season. And I just also want to mention this rule I call as one of the few rules of sports time travel. And I want to explain why I do this. So the reason I go back exactly 50 or exactly 60 or 70 years ago is because what I have found is for me to maintain this feeling like I've actually gone back in time, I have to do it one day at a time, day by day. And so when I'm following a team, I'll go back exactly 50 or exactly 60 years because I can't, if I go back, I can't follow too many threads, so to speak. So I can go back 50, 60, 70, but if I can't at the same time go back 51 and 52 and 53, what happens is that you just kind of start to lose the feeling. It all gets muddled together. But because I'm going back every day, I'm looking in the newspapers exactly 50 years ago and exactly 60 years ago, I get the feeling. It's something hard to describe, but I actually have the feeling of being there because I'm kind of in the flow. I know what's coming. Like, for example, with the Mets, I always know when Seaver's pitching. And it's really exciting knowing, oh, tomorrow, Tom Seaver's pitching, almost as though it's happening now. And that's the real excitement that I get out of doing this personally. And I think that excitement is what comes through in my articles, in my podcasts. And so if I violated that law of sports time travel and started just kind of randomly going back 47 years here and 62 years there, I just wouldn't be able to stay in the moment. And so, so I'm going to be going back exactly 60 years to follow Jim Brown.
Well, I can attest to you as one of your readers and the listeners that we appreciate you sticking into that niche and staying to those rules of the 50 years, or so we can follow that team through to the end, or this whatever story you're covering. So it's much appreciated, and it's less confusing with no distraction being able to follow those teams. So great job on that. So you said you wanted to say besides the Nets that you had some other things that for folks to look forward to on the Sports Time Traveler.
Well, it was the two things are the Cleveland Browns with Jim Brown and this fall, and then in the spring, the New York Nets with Dr. J. So those are the two projects, so to speak. And I just want everybody to know I won't just be following those things. So in the last several weeks, I've covered lots of other sports. I covered the British Open golf tournament in 1973. The Wimbledon tennis tournament in 1973. So I'm covering lots of other things, and I will continue to do that. But I'll have a larger focus on Jim Brown and in the fall, and Dr. J and the New York Nets in the spring. And by the way, I'm very open to suggestions from fans. So if anybody has anything they really want me to follow, I'd be happy to do that. And let me give you a great example. Towards the end of last year, I had one of my readers write to me and said, hey, in 1973, I'd really like you to follow Secretariat and Secretariat's bid for the Triple Crown in horse racing. And I have to admit, until that fan wrote that to me, I really hadn't thought about that. I probably would have maybe looked at it. Maybe I would have written an article on the Belmont Stakes when he finished winning the Triple Crown. But I guarantee I wouldn't have really followed Secretariat and written a whole series of articles going back to the race before the Kentucky Derby that he actually loses. I was stunned to find that out. And then all three of his Kentucky Derby races, Triple Crown races. And then just this past weekend, I followed another race of Secretariat, which also stunned me. Secretariat on August, I think it was August 5th or August 4th, 1973, ran his first race after the Belmont Stakes. So the first race after he's won the Triple Crown and solidified his legacy. He runs the Whitney Stakes at Saratoga Racecourse in Saratoga Springs, New York, and he loses. I was just stunned by this because, you know, we think of Secretariat, and rightfully so, as maybe the greatest horse in history. And yet Secretariat lost the race before the three Triple Crown races and lost the first race after the Triple Crown races. So I thought that was just fascinating. And this brings up another rule of the of sports time travel. My other main rule is I don't look ahead. So when I'm so even though I already told you kind of the arc of the story of what's going to happen with the Mets, I am not looking ahead. So I don't know day by day. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow until I read the newspaper archives on it. And I am not going to read ahead for the rest of this 1973 season. I know what happened because I remember it from when I was 9 years old, 50 years ago. But I don't know what happened day by day. And that's one of the things that kind of makes it so exciting for me. So readers, I just want my readers to know, if you're reading my articles and podcasts, I'm never going to tell you what's going to happen. I'm going to keep it in the moment. And that kind of keeps the feeling that you're there. The minute, what I found when I was starting to develop this is the minute you start looking ahead, the minute you get curious and say, oh, I'm going to look ahead a month or 2 months and see what happens, then you kind of lose it. You lose this feeling that you've gone back in time. And that's what I'm personally trying to maintain that, because that's what really makes it personally exciting.
Yeah. Okay. Now I'm going to ask sort of an open-ended question to you. And from your personal standpoint of writing and following these rules, now the Mets, you were 9 years old, you were probably just getting into sports and following it, and those were your heroes, and you knew how that scenario is going to play out, just like you said earlier. But maybe perhaps like the Jim Brown or the Secretariat examples, where you really don't remember, or maybe just never, you weren't old enough to appreciate what happened, and you're following that almost like it's happening in real time. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could explain what are some of your personal perks that you get from each of those examples?
Well, especially the ones that I never knew anything about, those are the ones that are really special. Every time I come across a story that I knew nothing about, you know, it is almost like it's happening now, because if you don't know what happened, then it really makes it exciting. I think the story I told when I was on the Pigskin Dispatch about the 1932 Colgate team, that was just stunning to find out that there was a team that went unscored upon for a whole season. It is just unbelievable. And I still can't believe that happened. And well, like with Secretariat, I remember Secretariat winning the Triple Crown, but I didn't know anything about the Whitney Stakes 2 months later. And so that was really stunning. When I in my article, I actually have the video of the Whitney Stakes from 50 years ago last weekend. And until I was watching it, I didn't know that Secretariat doesn't win the race. And so, you know, it's almost like, you know, you're watching, it has a feeling like you're watching it live. So the things you don't know that you find out about, that you never knew about, that you find out about, that's one thing that makes it interesting. And I'll tell you another thing that's really interesting about this whole experience here is it's kind of a shame that today in sports is kind of cluttered by the fact that it's become so commercial and the athletes are making so much money and athletes are moving back and forth across teams. There was something special about sports back in the 1970s, you know, like that Mets team. One of the reasons I felt like they were my team, like they were part of my identity, was I grew up with these players, and it was the same players for the most part year after year. There was a core group of players on that 73 team that had been on the 69 team. And so the whole time I was a fan of the Mets, those core players were always there. Now, you know, a lot of teams, there's almost 100% turnover in the personnel in 4 years. So it's hard to have the same allegiance to a team as, you know, now as you did back then.
Yeah. Okay. And something else you just spawned another a question out of me. Okay, with the Secretariat. Now, we did a story. We had the award-winning author, and I apologize, his name escapes me right now. He wrote a book on the Turcotte family of people that rode on the horses. And Ron Turcotte, of course, rode Secretariat through his Triple Crown. When it was Ron Turcotte the jockey in both those losses too?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he was the only one who rode Secretariat in 1973.
Okay. That's what I thought it was, but I thought maybe there was something, because I wasn't familiar with him losing that either, but maybe that was the magic bullet that somebody else wrote him. Okay.
Was that Raymond Wolfe that you, who wrote, he wrote a book about Secretariat?
No, this is on the Turcotte family, the whole, all the brothers of the Turcottes, it focused on Ron Turcotte, of course, but he had some brothers that had some great success in Canadian racing and coming down in the States in racing as well. But a very, very good book. And I'll have to look that up. We had it on Jersey Dispatch, and it's been a while. And I talked to so many people. His name escapes me right at the moment.
I was going to say, the reason I was mentioning Raymond Wolfe, who wrote a great book about Secretariat, is that his daughter has become one of my subscribers and has given me some great feedback. So that's a real honor.
No, absolutely. Well, why don't we take this opportunity, Len? Why don't you go ahead again and tell us where people can find your posts and find your podcast at?
So the easiest way to find me is to go to www.thesportstimetraveler.com. And actually, by the middle of this week, I will also have the URL www.sportstimetraveler.com. So thesportstimetraveler.com or sportstimetraveler.com. They'll both take you to the same website. And on my website, there's information about what I do, and there's links to go to see all my articles and podcasts. So my articles and podcasts are actually hosted on Substack. Substack is a platform that a lot of professional writers and sports writers are using for blogs and podcasts. So that's where they're actually hosted. But the URL to get there is hard to remember. So that's why I set up this splash page, thesportstimetraveler.com or sportstimetraveler.com.
Okay, very good. Len Furman, The Sports Time Traveler, we thank you once again for sharing this great story in sports history, the 73 Mets, and we look forward to some of your other works that you have coming out, and we'll have you on again to talk about some of those in the future. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Darren. It was a pleasure.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the Official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the Official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.